The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, coming to you now from a beautiful, sunny Edstone, England. We've got, I guess, Mr. Flurry out of town, Mr. McDonald out of town, and they're missing some absolutely gorgeous weather. Beautifully warm, clear skies. It's been just a great weekend, I think. I mean, I've travelled a fair bit. There are lots of really awesome sites in lots of countries. I might be a bit biased, though, but I don't think anywhere in the world does springtime as well as England. It's just been some absolutely beautiful weather. We went to the Cotswolds yesterday for a bit of a hike and a picnic. Had a really good time there. But unfortunately, we've got lots of pretty sobering news to talk about on the show today, especially to start. Lots and lots of different big events going on over the news. I kind of already felt by about Wednesday, Thursday, there's too much to talk about. And then we had some dramatic events over the weekend, especially with that attack in Sri Lanka. The latest figures on that bombing put the death toll at around 300. And this was a major attack, basically designed by radical Islamist groups to start a war with Christendom, a declaration of war on the Catholic Church. And Christianity worldwide there in Sri Lanka. It's also an attack, an event that cuts pretty close to some of our members over in Sri Lanka and from Sri Lanka. We'll talk about that more in just a second. Ukraine has a new president, another big event over the weekend. A comedian with no political experience is now at the head of the only European country right now actively engaged in war. Well, I guess Russia is also a European country. Russia and Ukraine both fighting over there, and Ukraine has a new leader. And, of course, the American news is still dominated by the Mueller report. We'll talk about that if we have time towards the end of the show. But, as I said, for the first segment, I want to talk about that attack in Sri Lanka. So there have been over 290 people killed, hundreds injured. I think the latest figures I saw were around 500 in a series of bomb attacks that were synchronized, deliberately timed to hit packed churches of Christians, of Catholics in Sri Lanka celebrating Easter Sunday. They targeted four hotels, three Catholic churches. I think there was another bomb somewhere else, a total of eight explosions. There was also a pipe bomb that they found and prevented near the airport in the capital. It's the worst violence in Sri Lanka since the end of its civil war a decade ago. I think it's the worst terrorist attack in Southeast Asia since the Mumbai attack. I think that was sometime around maybe 2011, something like that. And it seems that it's all been orchestrated by a radical Islamic terrorist group. There are strong signs becoming clearer and clearer of links to the Islamic State. Now, the attack, it began in the churches at around 8:45, and it was, as I said, timed for morning services on Easter Sunday, where the churches would be some of the busiest of any time in the year. They deliberately chose a time that, to the Catholics keeping these days, would be the, and most Christians in Sri Lanka are Catholic, but they deliberately timed it to be the most sacred day to these people. One that would have the biggest resonance to Christians all around the world. So they targeted churches in the capital, Colombo, in nearby towns in the west of the country where Colombo is, as well as a city on the other side, on the east coast. One of the worst attacks was at the Church of St. Sebastian's in Negombo, a few miles north of Colombia. When I wrote this article yesterday, I wrote that 50 died. I think the figure is now more like 100. And the pictures from that attack are just horrific, with the roof caved in, dead bodies all over the floor, blood splattered all up the walls. A priest told CNN, "You can see pieces of flesh thrown all over the walls." These were really horrific and professional, or at least well-planned, very successful attacks. People put whichever organization was behind them, and we'll talk about that in a minute, put a lot into, and there's some very capable people launching these attacks. St. Anthony's Shrine, it's a historic Catholic church in the capital. It was targeted, and again, that's a very symbolic site. It's one of the oldest churches in the country. The outside is kind of renewed, but on the inside, it's got a very historic building there. It hit some luxury hotels, some five-star hotels where the planners knew lots of foreigners would be staying. Shangri-La Hotel, Kingsbury, Cinnamon Grand Hotel. And again, they were interviewing some of the waitstaff, and they were saying, yeah, this was one of the busiest times of the year for us. Easter Sunday breakfast, people were gathered there with their families. I think there was somebody who's a celebrity chef in Sri Lanka was there eating breakfast with her extended family, caught up in this attack. Around the latest figures I saw were around 35 foreigners reported dead. Could be more by now. The Sri Lankan foreign minister, he said the attacks were a well-coordinated attempt to create murder, mayhem, and anarchy. And as I said, these attacks did cut close to some of our members. We have a couple living from Sri Lanka living here in the UK. They both went to school in Negombo, the location of where that St. Sebastian Church was attacked. Three of our members in Sri Lanka live within 3 miles from one of the attacks. One member had relatives that were in the attack. They know people that died in these attacks. So, well, it's an important reminder there to keep praying for the protection of God's people all around the world as we see more and more of these kind of attacks going on. Now, as I said, there's already been some evidence to point to the perpetrators of this attack. Nobody has claimed responsibility yet, but the government, a government official said that these attacks were carried out by the domestic militant group, the National Threlfecht Jamatha. I've probably completely butchered that pronunciation. I'm sorry. They said that there were 7 suicide bombers from this particular group. It's a Muslim group based in Sri Lanka, though there is a movement that they have some kind of affiliations with, I believe, in India. Another Muslim group there. But all of the bombers from this group were Sri Lankan. But they also said that the authorities suspect foreign links as well. This group, they kind of rose, they gained notoriety last year when they attacked Buddhist statues. And just 10 days ago, the government or the intelligence agency, they issued a warning, or the Sri Lankan police chief issued a warning that stated a foreign intelligence agency has reported that the NTJ, that's that militia group, is planning to carry out suicide attacks targeting prominent churches as well as the Indian High Commission in Colombo. So they had that warning. That warning was put out, I think, on April 11th. And then here come these attacks. So they had some notice, but they still weren't able to stop them. Now, like I said, there are some potential linking these attacks to the Islamic State as well. Muslims from Sri Lanka have been found supporting terrorist groups in Syria. And so people have speculated, well, maybe terrorists returning from the Middle East after the defeat of the Islamic State there could have been involved in the attack. The agency France Press yesterday noted that in January, Sri Lankan police seized a haul of explosives and detonators stashed near a wildlife sanctuary following the arrest of 4 men from a newly formed radical Muslim group. So you're seeing some new groups set up there, and one of our members from Sri Lanka also pointed out you're seeing more and more Muslim migrants coming in and moving into some of these areas from Pakistan, from Iran. So potentially there are there's the potential for more extremists to come in amongst that migration. Like I mentioned, these seem to be very sophisticated attacks with these big bombs going off at the same time. That implies an organization with a very capable organization, one with practice at coordinating these kind of attacks. The director of the SITE intelligence group, I forgot to note down her name, but she tweeted that though unclear who responsible and if foreigners involved, Sri Lanka would be an easily accessible target for regional Islamic State supporters. Southeast Asia, mostly Philippines and Indonesia, have seen a surge of centrally coordinated Islam or ISIS activity via the East Asian province. Would not be surprising if this is the case. And she noted, furthermore, today's bombings, albeit far more deadly, mirror January 2019 bombings on Roman Catholic Church in Jola, Sulu in the Philippines, in which ISIS claimed responsibility. At this point, ISIS channels posting rampantly, praying, may Allah accept the attackers, celebrating casualties, etc. She wrote that they are clearly paving the way for ISIS to claim responsibility. While such a claim may frame the operation as a revenge for New Zealand, this was likely planned long before. And just in the last few hours, the Islamic State has started, or I've seen reports at least, of the Islamic State posting pictures of some of those that they claim were the attackers here standing in front of an Islamic State flag. So it does seem that they have links or at least support from Islamic State just trying to get these attacks going on Christians. And like I said, it's a hugely symbolic attack here to try and carry out attacks on churches on Easter Sunday. And that's not lost on people. The Daily Beast had an article today. Is Sri Lanka Easter Massacre a bid to revive global holy war? And they wrote, whoever carried out the coordinated massacre at churches and hotels in Sri Lanka, the shockwaves will be felt near and far. And they begin by talking about how Catholic Church in Manhattan, in New York, had New York NYPD counterterrorism police posted outside their buildings on Sunday. And they mentioned that this isn't connected to the Sri Lanka attack. It was been planned for a long time in advance. But they note the need is there to post counterterrorism police outside Catholic churches, even in America. This article states Christian churches, along with Jewish synagogues, Buddhist shrines, and Shiite Muslim mosques, have been prime targets for violent jihadists, whether from the so-called Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, or groups or individuals most of the world has never heard of. Especially from the perspective of ISIS and those it inspires, places of worship have the great advantage of great symbolism and virtually no defenses. And an attack in one particular part of the world can lead to an attack elsewhere. If the death toll is high enough, which is certainly the case with the coordinated bombings in Sri Lanka, the shock will reverberate around the globe. And that's exactly what we've seen in Sri Lanka. British Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, he spoke about this growing trend in context of the Sri Lankan attacks since that has taken place. And here's the statement that he gave.
The reality is that attacks on Christians have been growing. 3,000 deaths in the last year alone. That was double the previous year, and perhaps there hasn't been as much attention focused on the persecution of Christians as there should have been, and that's why the Foreign Office has asked for an independent review to be done by the Bishop of Truro to look into what more we in the UK could do to defend the rights of Christians across the world.
Now, notice he didn't say who was responsible, which I think was a little bit weak of him, but people are seeing the trend. There's this uptick of attacks on Christians. There's, as the Daily Beast article said, a bid to revive a global holy war. The Pope, he spoke about the attacks in his traditional Easter message to the world, to the city and the world that he gave yesterday, just saying, well, I wish to express my affectionate closeness to the Christian community there, hit while it was gathered in prayer, and to all the victims of such cruel violence. The Archbishop of Colombo, Cardinal Malcolm Ranjith, I've got his statement here. We can play that now.
I also like to ask the government to hold a very impartial, strong inquiry and find out who is responsible behind this act, and also to punish them mercilessly.
Punish them mercilessly. Now, he did make clear he was asking for the government to do that, and he clearly called for people not to try and take anything into their own hands. But they're calling for a holy war, and they're getting some response there. Punish them mercilessly. I think, though, a very understandable statement. And it, as I said, an attack on churches during Easter Sunday Mass, you know, that's one of the most deliberately provocative acts imaginable. But when you understand Islamic State's ideology, it makes a lot of sense. They've been very clear that one of their big objectives is to provoke an attack between Islam and Christianity. And they're not the only ones that feel this way. That is a feeling throughout the Muslim world, in certain, or at least I should say throughout extremists in the Muslim world, that their mission is to provoke an attack. The Islamic State has their particular brand of it, but it's one that's shared by many different groups. So, for example, they have their slick, professional-looking propaganda magazine, and this was one of the things that distinguished Islamic State from some of the other groups, was just how professional-looking a lot of their propaganda material was. But that magazine is called Dabiq, and it's named after the place that they believe that a European army would land in the Middle East and attack. And in their, the very first issue of their magazine, their propaganda magazine, outlined their vision of end time events. And they believed that an army of Muslims from Medina would defeat these Europeans. And they wrote that then this army will conquer Constantinople, and said that in the ensuing struggle, Jesus would descend from heaven and lead the Islamic armies to victory. Because according to Islamic teaching, Jesus is a Muslim prophet. And so they that was their version of end-time events. But they believed that critical to that was triggering this response from crusader armies, from European powers. And so because of that, they continually threatened Europe and Christians. You know, they claimed to be plotting an attack on the Vatican and the Pope, and they continually put out these videos threatening them. Most recently, just in the run-up to Christmas last year, you saw similar things in Egypt with an attack on the largest cathedral in Africa. And this incredibly important site in Egypt, where there was an attempt to, and coincidental with that attack was an attempt to kill the Coptic Pope, the head of the Coptic Christians there in Egypt. So there's clearly a widespread attempt in the Muslim world to try and, as the Daily Beast said, revive a global holy war. Now, this is something that we watch closely at the Trumpet, because the Bible forecasts this kind of a clash. We have one of our trends articles on our website is why the Trumpet forecasts a clash of civilizations. It's in the trends section of our website. But Daniel chapter 11 forecasts this clash towards the end of that chapter, starting right in around verse 40, where a lot of that chapter talks about some history, and then at the end there it says, at the time of the end, and it talks about a clash between the king of the south and the king of the north. These two different powers. And you can go back and even to the, as that trends article does, it goes back to some of these very early articles that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flowery was writing all the way back in the early 90s, you know, things like 1992. Making some specific forecasts about this coming clash, about how radical Islam would be led by Iran, would be this king of the south. And he, even all the way back then in the early 90s, you know, he looked at this prophecy, he could see that, okay, well, who's this king of the south going to be? Who is this major power that can rise to prominence in the Middle East? This scripture tells us in verse 42 and 43 that Egypt is going to be allied with this king, the king of the south, so will Libya, so will Ethiopia. It tells us that the king of the north will conquer Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. So that, of course, means that if the king of the north conquers these powers while fighting the king of the south, that those powers are on the king of the south's side. You know, what can draw together these different groups in the area of Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa there, with Egypt, Libya, and just create a major power within the Middle East? Well, radical Islam can unify those different groups. And Iran was clearly rising as the major power there. And there are, who else in that general area has the clout to be the king of the south. So Mr. Flory pointed to that in the early 90s, and he said, you know, watch Iran. Iraq is going to fall to Iran. That was even the title of one of those articles from back in the early 90s. Is Iraq about to fall to Iran? And, well, we heard just on Trumpet Hour on Friday, just more evidence that that has now happened. Brent Nachtigall has an article in the latest Trumpet print edition just showing how much control Iran has of Iraq already. You know, they're in the bag. Just like Mr. Flory said would happen back in the early 90s. Iraq has fallen to Iran. Iran is this growing king of the south. And it's gaining leadership of radical Islam. So radical Islam, led by Iran, is this king of the south. And there's this, and so this talks about a clash. The king of the south shall push at the king of the north. So it continually tries to provoke the king of the north. And what do we see? Well, we see radical Islam continually trying to provoke Europe. And so we see, well, the king of the north, that's referring to this European power. We can see that because, well, who's just to the north of this area? To the north of the Middle East and Egypt and some in, you know, this general vicinity? Well, it's Europe. And we can see the kings of the east are mentioned, or tidings out of the east and out of the north in verse 44 are mentioned separately. That is clear. That's a reference to major powers that are to the north and to the east of the Middle East. So that's clearly a reference to Russia and to China and some of these major Asian nations. So the king of the north isn't referring to them. The king of the north isn't referring to Britain or America, because these are Gentile powers. And as you can prove in our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Britain and America, well, they're descended from the nations of Israel. And you can also see just from the whole sweep of Daniel chapter 11 that the king of the north, earlier in this chapter, when it goes through some of that history, it's talking about a power in Syria. And then Syria was conquered by the Roman Empire, absorbed into the Roman Empire. And then we jump forward to it, the time of the end. And, well, who's the successor to the Roman Empire? Well, it's Europe. And so you can see Europe, the heart of Christianity, them being pushed at by the king of the south. And you can see in verse 41, right at the heart of this push, this conflict between these two powers, is the Middle East, is Jerusalem. It says, he shall enter into the glorious land. So you can see some indications of the religious nature of this clash. You can see that even in verse 45, it's talking about the victorious king of the north now having defeated this king of the south, this radical Islamic power. It says, and he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas, in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So that's talking about him setting up his throne in Jerusalem. Mr. Flory in the King of the South book, he writes, notice, the religious leader will move his headquarters to Jerusalem, and not just for protection. He could go on to many other cities that would be safer, but this will be a religious act of faith. This religious leader considers Jerusalem to be the most holy place on earth, the center of the universe. So you can see, even just bound up in these four or five verses, when you start to look into them, the indications of this being a religious conflict between the king of the north and the king of the south. You know, Jerusalem features prominently in here. It all revolves around the glorious lands, Israel, and Jerusalem in verse 45 there. And we see that Jerusalem is a holy city for both of these religions, for both Islam and for Europe. You know, if they're just after, say, strategic territory or this kind of thing, there are other places that are probably more important. But instead, this clash all revolves around Jerusalem. It has this very religious nature. You see this in, you know, Iranian propaganda especially. They have this laser-like focus on Jerusalem. We've been hearing about the Quds Force a fair bit, this branch of the Revolutionary Guards that supports terrorism, and now the Revolutionary Guards have been designated as a terrorism organization. But, you know, that even that name, Al-Quds, that's the Islamic name for Jerusalem. Iran celebrates Quds Day or Jerusalem Day, where they display their support for the Palestinians and have a big military parade and talk about conquering Jerusalem. Mr. Flurry, in the King of the South booklet, wrote, "Few people understand this Muslim passion for Jerusalem and its holy sites. It is the kind of passion that causes war." Later in that chapter, he wrote, Soon they will push at the King of the North, the so-called Holy Roman Empire, the same religious power that was behind the Crusades, and that push will surely revolve around Jerusalem." Now, there's a lot of other scriptures that confirm the religious nature of the King of the North. And Mr. Armstrong used to say that the Bible is like a jigsaw puzzle. You put the different pieces together from different locations and a clear picture emerges. And it really is incredible as you look at you take these prophecies from Daniel and you can put them alongside prophecies from John and the book of Revelation that was written 500-600 years after the book of Daniel, and they slot perfectly together. Because you can look in the book of Revelation and it talks about the same power, the King of the North, albeit in different terms. It talks about it as a beast power. And in Revelation 17, it talks about this beast power being ridden by a woman. And you can see throughout the Bible that the woman is a symbol of a church. You know, God talks about the true church being the bride of Christ. And then he often portrays false churches as being an adulterous woman, or the false church as being an adulterous woman. One who is not married to Christ. And one that goes out and commits fornication with the kings of this world. That's what Revelation chapter 17 talks about. It's a prophecy of a major power in Europe led by a religious power. And so you put that alongside Daniel 11 and you see a really clear picture emerging of a religious war, or as Mr. Flurry called it in the King of the South booklet. He has a chapter there called The Last Crusade, a so-called holy war between the King of the North and the King of the South. And that's what you see building with these attacks like the one in Sri Lanka. You know, Sri Lanka obviously is not in Europe, but it's a deliberate attack wherever they get the opportunity against Christianity. That's what they're going after. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it was all against Catholic targets here. You know, you look at the Islamic State's propaganda, and I said, you know, the Islamic State as a group, as an official organization, may well be defeated, but there's a huge number of people in that area, just of Muslims around the world, that hold similar beliefs. Maybe that organization there in Syria may not exist anymore, but there's still a lot of people in that area of Syria that have a similar worldview of trying to provoke this kind of a clash. So you see that you can more clearly see the religious nature of this power in looking at nations like, or groups like Islamic State. But you can see the rise of religion in Europe as well. And this is why we watch so closely for the rise of religion in Europe. This is why we talked about the aftermath of the fire in Notre Dame when I was on this show last week. And I'll read a few quotes from a few different stories that came out since I did that show, because I think it's just really been really interesting to see Europe's response to this attack. You know, lots of very religious rhetoric, exactly as we've been talking about, exactly as we've been saying. Look, there's going to become this, you know, Europe is going to become a religious power. A lot of people have been surprised by the strength of religious feeling to what's happened in Notre Dame. And so you can see this rise in how religion, people realizing how important religion is to them, is to Europe. And then that, the Bible says, well, you're going to see this rise in religion in Europe, and it's going to help lead to this coming crusade. Robert Hardman, he had an article on the Daily Mail talking about, well, the title was something like Divine Inspiration. I didn't write the title, but Divine Inspiration, Now Uniting France. He quoted someone saying, so many people have become Catholics once again. You saw those pictures of people praying on the streets of France, singing hymns on the streets of France. New York Times had an article over the weekend, why did non-believers grieve for Notre Dame? And they wrote in there, well, one could be forgiven for asking why. Why has there been such a big response? Why has over €1 billion been dedicated to this cathedral? You know, there have been some people talking about and saying, well, look, we've got all of these problems in the world. We've got all of this poverty in all the different areas, so many different different things that could need our money. Why is it that Notre Dame's cathedral is what can gain over $1 billion in donations so quickly and still rising? You know, why are people so eager to give to that and not to some of these other causes? Well, I think a lot of those other causes are not ones that you can easily solve with money, whereas it's easy to see how money can help rebuild Notre Dame. So that's part of the answer. But there is obviously a very potent pull here. This article from the New York Times, well, just talks about how just 6% of French go to mass, down from 35% half a century ago. But then it asks, after what we've seen with Notre Dame, is there a latent Catholicism in France that we fail to see? And it writes in there, certainly the continuing relevance of Catholicism to French life has been underestimated. Tom Holland had an article in The Spectator, the latest edition, over the weekend. It was their cover article, actually. He writes, Notre Dame provides the French with evidence that their modern and secular republic has its foundations deeply rooted in the Middle Ages. Notre Dame has always been more than just an assemblage of stone and stained glass. It is a monument as well to a specifically Christian past. And he writes, perhaps then the debts of the contemporary West to Christianity is more deeply rooted than many believe, believers and non-believers alike. And this is something that we drew attention to in our Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy booklet. Or book, I guess. It's it's well over 100 pages, nearly 200 pages. That definitely counts as a book. As we quote in the historian Thomas Woods, he wrote in a book, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, that Western civilization owes far more to the Catholic Church than most people realize, Catholics included. The church, he writes, in fact, built Western civilization. And as we say in there, that's a bit of an exaggeration. Obviously, there was a big influence from the English-speaking West, English-speaking civilization that had a distinctly anti-popish, anti-Catholic identity. But still, his point that the Catholic Church has a much bigger role in Europe and in Western civilization than most people believe is absolutely correct. This book states, the Vatican has presided over the rise and fall of kings and governments, the emergence of political and ideological movements, and the discovery of and colonization of new lands and people. The Catholic religion has influenced every facet of Western society, from art and music to science to the measurement of time to the annual holidays we celebrate. Its influence over Europe is even more extensive. It has shaped Europe's legal systems, its educational institutions, many of its prominent cities, its economy, even agriculture. And that is what more and more are realizing in the aftermath of these attacks. Deutsche Welle, they had an article again also over the weekend where they wrote, Europe is so much more than a common currency zone and an economic union. Europe is also a cultural realm, and Notre Dame Cathedral is one of its central symbols. That's why it's appropriate and welcome that the super rich are getting their checkbooks out to help rebuild the cathedral. In the end, the reconstruction of Notre Dame will be a symbol of hope. Project Syndicate last week, they said something similar. They said, looking ahead, what are we to think? What should we do? We must hope that Notre Dame's sacrifice will awaken slumbering consciousness, that through this disaster, people will realize that Europe is Notre Dame writ large. More than a political union, it is a great work of art, a brilliant bastion of shared intelligence, but also home to an endangered legacy. That legacy is too important to lose. We cannot allow pyromaniacs to divert the people of Europe. We must remember that we together are builders of temples and palaces, creators of beauty. That is the lesson of Notre Dame in this Holy Week. So why are people talking, saying, well, Notre Dame Cathedral is a symbol of the European Union? You know, why would people say that? On one hand, that can look pretty crazy. You know, European Union, it's this secular agreement between different governments and a supranational institution with a parliament. And the cathedral is a place built by the French state and the Catholic Church for people to go and celebrate their religion. Why would one be the symbol of the other? But then when you understand just how ingrained Catholicism and that religion is into Europe's fabric and way of life. And like we read from that quote from Laws and Method of Education, you know, even though Europe may be moving away from church attendance, it's not those Catholic pillars and foundations of European society are still there. And that's what the Notre Dame burning really shows, really exposes. And so that's why you have people making these kind of statements. And that's moving, and Europe is moving towards, you know, once again becoming this religious power. It's going to be part of this crusade and part of that clash with the King of the South. And I think the King of the Radical Islam, with its constant attacks on Christianity, is just going to accelerate that. And they're probably quite happy to accelerate that. That's their whole view, as I said, revolves around triggering a war with crusaders. So if they get Europe to become more militant about their religion, I think they'd be quite happy doing that. And so they're attacking these churches. And I think, you know, you saw what happened when just a church burns down. We see what happens. We're seeing more and more church attacks in Europe. But you can really see how that process of people realizing how much they appreciate their Catholic heritage just increasing a hundredfold if it's an Islamic group behind that. So you can clearly see this coming clash building. But there's one more point I want to make about this, and time is really moving on. We might have to ditch this short segment on the Mueller report, which, that's okay, there are better qualified people than me to talk about that anyway. But you know, one important point on this as we watch for this clash of civilizations is that the media is underreporting it. It's not getting the attention that it deserves. I mean, you saw this last week in the wake of the Notre Dame attack. I'll read an article from that, and even just how the attacks in Sri Lanka were reported. The Washington Post, they had an article where, you know, well, if you, as you saw Notre Dame Cathedral burning, and as you saw those pictures of those flames, if you saw that and if you thought, I wonder if radical Muslims were behind that. Well, according to the Washington Post, or at least according to Talia Levin, who wrote this article, then you're a racist. Now, you might think, well, actually, we've had Muslim groups carry out terrorist attacks. We've had Muslim groups say we want to trigger a war with Christians. We've had Muslim groups saying we are going to attack prominent Christian sites. We have had radical Muslims caught trying to attack Notre Dame Cathedral. Therefore, seeing those flames, well, it would be quite a logical possible reason that radical Islam could be behind it. That would be quite a logical deduction. You know, that you may think that way, but according to the Washington Post, you know, you're still racist. This individual, she wrote, many figures on the right took the opportunity to turn Notre Dame into a metonym for Western civilization as a whole, intimating that far more than a cathedral is at peril. Shortly thereafter, fast-talking, far-right pundit Ben Shapiro called Notre Dame a monument to Western civilization and Judeo-Christian heritage. I don't know how they can get away with calling Ben Shapiro far-right and not getting sued for libel or something like that, because he quite clearly isn't. Fast-talking, though, I guess, seems accurate. Though I guess you could probably level the same criticism quite justly at me. But there you go. He's racist because he called Notre Dame a monument to Western civilization and Judeo-Christian heritage. Though I do note, I did like Ben Shapiro's response, where it has in brackets in this article. On Tuesday, Shapiro called this article simply gross and said he called Notre Dame a monument to Western civilization, quote, because it is, which I think is a pretty fair defense. How twisted do you have to be to say someone's a racist because they say that Notre Dame is a symbol of Europe's Judeo-Christian heritage? It's literally a church. It's hard to get more kind of Christian than that. But this article goes on to say, given the already raging rumors about potential Muslim involvement, these tweets evoked the specter of a war between Islam and the West that is already part of numerous far-right narratives. And they called this baseless. This article called it baseless racist conspiracy peddling. And then just a few days after that article's published, saying, well, if you think Muslims want to attack churches, you're racist. Well, Muslims attack churches, killing 300 people. So this clash of civilizations is building. It is prophesied. But then as this article exposes, many on the left and many in the media don't want it to be happening. They don't want to believe this is a trend. They believe even talking about it is racist. And as I saw some of this trying to put together yesterday, an article on the attacks in Sri Lanka. You know, just even if you just leave aside Bible prophecy and just look at good journalism, if there is an attack, what is the single most important question people want answered about that attack? I mean, obviously, yes, where, how many people killed, how devastating, but who was behind it? That is the, you look at the headline, that many people killed, okay, who did this? That's the first thing that you want to learn as you see that headline. And it was so harder than it should have been to get the answers to that. You know, when I wrote that article, right there in the first paragraph, even though we might not have had all the information, that's the most important bit of information people want. So it appears radical Islamists were behind this attack. You can look up on the article and yesterday, that's in the first paragraph of my article. I was amazed how many articles didn't even mention it. And again, you know, we zero into that because of Bible prophecy, because we know the Bible prophesies that these attacks are coming. But you know, even with that aside, just good journalism, people want to know who did this. Now, because everyone is asking these questions, some articles at least did answer it, but many just ignored it. Those that did often buried it. There was a reluctance to report any names. And presumably that's because the names were clearly Muslim. You know, one of the people checked in under the name of Muhammad Azam Muhammad. So, you know, you read that name, it's pretty clear what organization is behind this attack. But even going on, even during the news report that we played at the top of the hour, this is 24 hours later, the Sri Lankan government has even come out and said, yeah, we believe that there was this Muslim terrorist group behind it. And even the news report that we played at the top of the hour is still going on about, well, there are potential groups. It could be radical Buddhists and it could be the Tamils. I mean, sure, right when the attack took place, it could have been those other groups. There's already now, though, plenty of evidence that it wasn't. And purely because a lot of journalists don't want to report on this angle, that is being downplayed. They're not just answering the questions people want answered. And that's why you're not seeing more about these church attacks that I mentioned last week in Europe. If there was anything like that for mosques, where you had a similar pattern of attacks, you would have heard about that endlessly. But because it's on churches, it's just not mentioned. Which, I mean, it causes genuine problems for people like us here at The Trumpet. You know, because the only people that do talk about these problems are then often outside the mainstream, but then they don't have the resources of the mainstream media. They don't fact-check things as thoroughly. So then they get facts wrong more often. And so that makes it, you know, it makes it harder for us to trust what they're saying. But that at the same time, the mainstream media that have all of their resources to go and actually find things out and get some reliable information, well, they don't cover it either. So then it does make it hard for us sometimes to get some reliable information on it. But this is a trend that's bigger than what you're seeing in the headlines, because the media don't want to cover it. But it's a crucial prophecy in the Bible, in those verses from Daniel 11, talking about that attack between the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, you can get the full prophetic picture that you need to on this attack from the King of the South. You know, that's even more important, the material that's in our booklet, The King of the South, and the news material that you're seeing every day, keeping you up to date with the trend. You know, that book will show you why this is prophesied in the Bible. It talks about where this is leading. As I said at the start, it's not a pleasant news story to talk about when you have all of these big attacks, and they are only going to get worse. But this book as well, it gives you the hope. It tells you where this is leading. It gives you an overview that you just can't get anywhere else. Because, well, if God prophesied about this in the book of Daniel 2,500 years ago, well, then that shows you that he's in control of these events. That they are playing out according to a clear plan. You know, the book of Daniel makes clear why God is allowing this to happen. You know, it's leading to a time when Jesus Christ will rule over the earth, when mankind is finally humble enough to admit, well, he doesn't know the answers. He doesn't know how to bring peace. And that he will submit to Jesus Christ. So that's where this is leading. That's what our book, The King of the South, our booklet, The King of the South, will tell you. Just a short little booklet there that will make clear exactly what's in this prophecy, what the Bible says about what's coming. I've given you a few bits and pieces to show who the King of the North is, who the King of the South is. But if you want to prove this to yourself, you really need our booklet, The King of the South, and go through and not just take my word for what the Bible says here. But go and take that booklet and prove, well, this is the King of the North. This is who the King of the South is. This is what the Bible says about is what's happening. And then you can see that happen in the news and know that all of this is leading to the best possible outcome. It's leading to Jesus Christ ruling over the whole earth. So you can read that on, you can get that booklet on our website, thetrumpet.com. Just click on the library there. And then I think if you click on literature or books and booklets, you get a link, a showcase of some four or five booklets. You can then go from there to see our whole library. You can order The King of the South. We'll send you a free copy. You can also read it online. If you want something a bit shorter, you can also read our trends article, Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. You can get to that just under the trends tab. Well, we'll take a very quick break. And when we get back, we'll ditch Robert Mueller. We'll just talk about the elections that have been happening over the weekend in Ukraine.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, we've just finished up talking about Sri Lanka, but another important event over the weekend is we had an election of a new president of Ukraine. It's a really interesting trend to see here. Instead of the old incumbent Petro Poroshenko, you had a new president elected by a landslide, Volodymyr Zelensky. He's a comedian. He has no political experience except for this. He plays the president in a TV comedy. In this TV show, he's a school teacher who basically accidentally becomes president. He gives this rant as a teacher, complaining or berating Ukraine's politicians for all being corrupt and all of their different political parties being corrupt. And someone records it. The video goes viral. And he ends up being elected president, despite not having any experience in the job. And so the actor that plays this guy has now actually become president in a pretty big landslide vote, it looks like, with the polls that we have so far. And he basically brought the same message as this fictional president. Everyone in politics is corrupt. We need an outsider. A moral outsider can come in and fix things and make things better. And there's some interesting points to take away from this. Simon Ostrovotsky, he gave a good summary of some of the wider implications of this election in an interview for Euronews that we'll play a clip from now.
Well, this is huge, and it's huge not just in Ukraine, but across the world, because think about it. The fictional president, the TV president, has become the real president, and that's a message to establishments all across the world. There's another reason this is important, and that's because he won by this landslide margin, unifying both the Ukrainian-speaking West and the Russian-speaking Southeast in opposition to the incumbent Petro Poroshenko.
So, I said won by a landslide, but you're seeing this idea that, you know, we need outsiders, that we need big change in politics and the way things are done. And that's something that spreads far beyond Ukraine. You know, Ukraine, yeah, they have challenges that are pretty different than the rest of Europe. They're in the middle of a war with Russia. They have some pretty big rampant corruption problems and things like that. But the anger at the elites and the mainstream, well, that spreads far. You had the Yellow Vest protest in France again this weekend on Saturday, marching through Paris, lighting fires, scattering small fires all the way they could around Paris, basically trying to say, look, you know, we need you donated a lot of money for the cathedral, but we need help as well. One of the cat placards said, we're worth a cathedral. Another one said, well, Victor Hugo thanks all those generous donations ready to save Notre Dame of Paris and proposes they do the same thing for Les Miserables, a riff on the title of two different Victor Hugo books. The Associated Press wrote that their reporters saw a car, motorbike, and barricades set ablaze around the Palace de la République Plaza in eastern Paris. The smell of tear gas mixed with smoke choking the air. So there's lots of people that would like a kind of an outsider, and you're seeing this trend now, and Ukraine's just the latest country. But they voted for him by a landslide, this guy that has pretty much no political experience. Just to give you an idea of some of his rhetoric, here's a report from Sky News on one of the presidential debate that took place just before the vote, where they translate some of the different bits from the speeches of the two individuals there.
36 hours till polls open, and this is the grand spectacle of Ukraine's election season. Petro Poroshenko battling to hold on to his presidency against Volodymyr Zelensky, a comedian with no political know-how who streaks ahead in the polls.
I am not a politician. I am not a politician at all. I am just a human being, an ordinary human being, who has come to break this system. I am the result, Petro Poroshenko, of your mistakes and promises.
Petro Poroshenko traded on his experience, 5 years as commander-in-chief in a grinding war in Ukraine's east, and on the suggestion that his opponent is little more than a blank canvas with few policies to speak of.
Today, we just see a beautiful candy wrapper, which is expensive and bright, and everyone sees in it what they want to see.
So there was some of their debate. Basically, he's saying, I'm a new guy, Zelensky, I'm a new guy. I'm not corrupt unlike these other guys. And then the more established politician, they're saying, well, no, he's just a big, shiny candy wrapper. There's nothing of any real substance there. You don't know him. You don't know what he's going to do. But like I said, I think that's interesting with you heard him say that, Zelensky say, break the system. And that's what people want increasingly all around the world. Break the system. And that's also what the Bible prophesies will happen in Europe. We mentioned Revelation 17 in the first half and this power that's coming in Europe, this beast power that's led by a church. But this power says that it has 10 kings. And it talks about one individual being over all of these kings. That's a pretty different government to what Europe has right now. You know, it's not 10 presidents, 10 elected prime ministers. It's 10 kings, 10 strongmen. It's describing a Europe where the system has been smashed, where people don't like the leaders that democracy gives them. And so you see in Europe already outsiders doing well time and time again. We talked about this on Trumpet Hour on Friday, where in Finland, you have coming within 0.2% of being the largest, most successful party, the Finns Party, a pretty new upstart party outside of the political mainstream. You see in the European Parliament elections coming up, everyone getting ready for these new parties outside of the political mainstream. And as we talked about a bit on that show, a lot of elites are trying to blame this on Russia and say it's all Russian collusion. It's the failures of the mainstream that are driving people to want a new system, something else. And the Bible tells you where it's leading. It's leading to Europe eventually not just abandoning mainstream parties, but mainstream politics, the way of doing politics, voting in these strong men and these strong rulers. But then I think another important angle to watch here in Ukraine is just to watch its war, basically, with Russia. I mean, Russia tries to hide it by backing proxy groups. And could this go in a bit of a different direction with this new president? Potentially, I think that it could. And he attracted support from both Eastern Ukraine and Western Ukraine, from both people who spoke Ukrainian as their first language and Russian as their first language, kind of bridging that divide there. Could he help unify the country? Could he make it a harder target for Putin? Well, potentially. Or on the other hand, you know, he's inexperienced, he's new. Well, could Russia take advantage of him? Could it provide an opportunity for Russia to push further into Ukraine? Could this trend or could this change open up something there? Well, possibly. I think either way, it's an important to keep watching Ukraine and watching as that plays out. You know, there's another prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 38 that talks about a prince of Rosh, a strong leader of Rosh or of Russia. And that's the role that Vladimir Putin plays in Bible prophecy. And so anything that revolves around him is important to keep watching. Could we see more evidence of him playing this role as the Prince of Rosh? Europe is rising to the prominence as this Russian leader that's against the United States and ultimately in the end against Europe. So keep watching Ukraine. We could see more of his rise. We've seen very clear evidence in Ukraine already of Putin acting as a strong man. You can read more about that in our book, The Prophesied Prince of Rosh. That's also on our website, thetrumpet.com, under the literature tab. So again, if you want to learn more about Russia, just please go online and read that. Well, that's about all I have time for. If you want to hear more about Robert Mueller, you can go back and you can listen to Friday's show, where Mr. Dwight Falk gives a rundown of some of the latest news from him. You can also tune in again to hear more from us tomorrow here at kpcg.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial.